Hungry for spicy food and even hotter conversations? Craving community and authentic storytelling? Then join the table. This is Minor Legends, a new comedy fiction podcast supported by Potluck. Pull up every week with me, Angela Wong Carbone, and follow the stories of me and my friends as we serve up tasty tales of what it means to be Asian American at our weekly dinner hang. If you enjoy deep dishing on absurd stereotypes like tiger moms who tutor your dating game rather than grades, the insanity of your parents' immigration story, to the legend of that one good Asian cousin you can never live up to, then pull up a seat and grab a plate. Featuring dinner guests like Ronnie Chang, Brian Park, Usama Siddiqui, Celia Au, Perry Young, Supriya Ganesh, and more. It's a tasty rotation that'll leave you belly laughing and steeped in relatable and spicy conversations. Can you take the heat? Listen now for free wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today with an author chat with Yume Kitase to chat about her latest novel, Salt Crop. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official Patreon supporter, you can access to our members-only Discord server. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you can also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, as well as the opportunity to help us pick a patron's choice book club pick once per quarter.
So we had a pretty great chat with Yume Kitase about her new novel, Salt Crop, which is set in the near future, which is kind of terrifying, where seas have consumed coastal cities and highways disintegrate underwater, and there are mutant fish lurking in pirate-controlled depths. And it follows the story of two sisters who are sailing on a boat to find their missing sister. And we talked to Yume about sisterhood, about climate change, about corporations having way too much power. All the things that we love to talk about on the show. So.
I mean, the thing about near future speculative fiction is it's pretty close to home.
I've seen this film before.
Yeah, I think Yume does a really great job painting a picture of what could happen. And I think I mentioned this in the conversation, but as a new father, it was terrifying. This was a horror story for me. But we had a really great chat with Yume, so please enjoy our conversation with Yume Kitase.
And we are here with Yume Kitase, a Brooklyn-based Japanese and American writer of speculative fiction. She is the author of The Deep Sky, The Stardust Grail, and most recently released Salt Crop. Welcome to the show, Yume.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, it's nice to meet you too. So I usually like to start off our episodes with a little icebreaker. And I was looking at your bio, or maybe it was like a different interview. But
yeah.
I know you have two cats. So tell me about your fur babies.
My fur babies. Yeah, no. So I have two cats. They're kind of old now. I got them on the day that Superstorm Sandy landed in New York. And they were about to shut the trains off. And my twin sister sort of stayed there and brought them back home on a cardboard box right before they shut the subways down. So there are little Superstorm Sandy babies. Their names are Boondoggle and Filibuster.
I love, by the way.
Like, thank you.
Very unique names.
Yes. A Boondoggle is a government project that costs a lot of money and is sort of pointless. Like, it just wastes a lot of taxpayer dollars. And Boondoggle is a very big eater. He has no appetite control. And Filibuster obviously is a big meower. So they're kind of old now, but they don't act old. And I love them. They're very cuddly.
Did you name them after observing their behavior after a while? Or was it like you named them and then...
Yeah, they became the names. I mean, I named them because I thought it was funny to have like these like funny names, but that could be shortened to something that sounds almost like a human. So their nicknames are Phil and Boone. It just sort of happenstance that they ended up fitting their names really well.
That's really, really funny.
Yeah.
I was curious about it when I looked up what your cat's names were, and I was like, wow, very,
yeah.
very unique.
Filibuster often marches around the house meowing loudly. Like, it sounds sort of like a child saying, won't somebody play with me? Yeah. Except it's 4 a.m.
Of course. It's like having a baby. I love just like clever pet names. My cousin had a dachshund named Nacho, and he was a very good boy.
That's so cute. Yeah. That's cute.
There's a pug I follow on Instagram, and his name is Wonton, and I'm like, that is the best pug name.
Yeah, food names I have ever heard. Dogs, so cute. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, excited to have you on the show, Yume. You're a name that we always see a lot on our book announcements. So really glad to finally get you on the podcast. So we like to start off our author chats by learning more about our authors and their journey to becoming a published novelist. And I'm really interested to learn more about your personal story as someone who not only has published several books, but also had like a whole other career before becoming a novelist. So can you please share with our listeners your journey to becoming a writer?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have always been a writer. I started writing quite young. I wrote my first novel when I was 13, and it wasn't particularly good, but it was a novel, which is, no easy thing is to like get through something that long. And then I wrote another one in high school, which also wasn't very good. And a third one in college, still not very good. And then I wrote a fourth one after I graduated college, and that was the one that I queried. And that one wasn't, that one got me an agent, but actually ultimately didn't sell. So I wrote a fifth one, and that fifth one was The Deep Sky. So I think, my perspective, I always love to talk about this, especially the fact that my first book got me an agent but didn't sell, because at the time that it happened, I had been, doing what all new authors do or new writers do and reading all of those success stories on the internet. And I felt like a really big failure. And now that I've published a couple books and I know a lot of authors, I realize now that that actually is quite a common story, that like the first book that you write is very rarely the first book that you publish. And to be an author usually requires writing, multiple books. I like to talk about that just because I think it's important for people to hear that it's not failure to not sell your first book. It's actually quite common. And in retrospect, I'm glad that the first book that sold is the first book that sold, because I think, each time I write a book, my writing is slightly better than the last. And, it's nice to know that, my quality is still improving, and that what is out there is quality that I'm okay with.
Yeah, I'm curious, like, were you always into speculative fiction? Like, were all your previous novels and manuscripts like in that genre? What fascinates you about it?
I love reading all kinds of books. I read pretty broadly in terms of my taste. It's kind of eclectic. I read a lot of Agatha Christie growing up. I read The Wizard of Oz. A lot of Star Wars books. I've always read a lot of different things, but I love speculative fiction the most. And I think, either the science fiction aspects or the fantastical elements, I think are just so much fun and just interesting. I love a really weird novel. I have yet to write something that's as weird as I think weird can be. But I think speculative fiction is just endlessly interesting.
Yeah, like I know that your day job previously was like working for government. I'm not exactly what you did, but I am curious as to how your day job helped you in writing speculative fiction, because I feel like their politics and speculative fiction are very intertwined.
I do too. And, I've thought a lot about this, and I think I've said this before, but politics and policy are inherently speculative, right? You're thinking about the future and you're thinking about what the future should be. So to me, the part of your brain that goes into that is very similar to the part of the brain that goes into writing speculative fiction. It's just a slight, the slight difference is that in speculative fiction, you might sometimes be sort of envisioning a future that you don't actually want to come true, especially like in the case of my new novel, Sawcrop is a dystopian novel. So certainly is not a future that I wish into existence. But in either case, I think to get to the, you know, a concept of the future, one of the questions that I'm constantly asking myself is, you know, what decisions are we making now and what, you know, in contemporary society and how would that sort of result in a future, a particular kind of future? And what would that look like if you play it out 30 years or 40 years? You know, or like, you know, based on the decisions that we're making now, how do we think that we're going to make decisions in the future? And often is not necessarily a optimistic sort of view, but always hopeful. And I think that's the other aspect of it is, for me, to work in government, you have to be inherently hopeful as a person, because
or else
obviously
you get ground down.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not slightly hopeful, what motivates you to keep doing it? If you don't think it's possible to make the world better. And I think that's that, like, people, I think, look at politics and think it's like a very cynical field. But actually, I think the people that I know who work in politics and government are actually sort of in that vein of like, they might have cynicism to them. But, you know, ultimately, I think they have to be a little hopeful or they wouldn't be doing the work that they're doing, because otherwise, what's the point? So I think when I write speculative fiction, I think you can sort of tell that I have maybe a more hopeful flavor to my writing than I think some writers, even when I'm writing a dystopian.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad for that, because your latest novel, Sawcrop, takes place in a very bleak but very believable world. Like, as someone who was like a new parent, I was just existentially terrified the entire time reading
it. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, for our listeners who aren't familiar with your latest novel, can you give us a brief synopsis of Sawcrop?
So it's about a world in the future, in the near future, that is very not so different from the world today. But the main difference is that the food is a little bit more scarce. There's been a blight that's like wiped out a lot of major agricultural products. Also fossil fuels are very scarce, which comes with that comes, you know, anything that's made with plastic, and global supply chains. So, it's a world that you recognize, but is, you know, kind of more worn down. And I will also add that, you know, as with today, who has technology and modern lifestyle is not, it's not distributed evenly among around the globe. In this case, the story starts in a place that was once prosperous and is now, you know, has fallen behind because of, you know, choices people have made about sustainable energy. So that's the context. The actual story is it's about two sisters who sail across the ocean in search of their missing sister. And they're trying to find her and save her from whatever she's gotten herself entangled in.
Yeah, a lot of your book takes place on a boat.
Yes.
Because, like you said, they sail across a coast to, like, find their sister, missing sister.
Yeah.
And I've asked this to authors who have also written stories on boats. I'm like, how much research did you do? Because,
yeah,
like, sailing is very technical. So
yes,
I am curious as to, like, where your knowledge came from.
Yeah, so... the short answer is a ton. I did a ton of research. I grew up sailing small keelboats in Rhode Island. Our grandparents lived in Rhode Island. And so in the summers, we would come back to the U.S. We were living in Japan at the time. We'd come back to the U.S. and we'd stay with them for a couple months and go sailing. We were a sailing camp. And so we learned a little. We learned a bunch there. But I've never actually sailed overnight to distant places. So I went down a lot of research rabbit holes. I read a lot of books. There's a lot of memoirs that you can read about people who've solo sailed around the world in keelboats, which are in small boats, which are, like, you know, awesome to read. And and then I also, you know, watched a ton of YouTube videos and looked at content online, because there's a lot of influencers now who like sort of capture their lifestyle. You know, they give you boat tours and stuff like that. So that was also part of it. And then I found actually a young woman who lives in Arctic Norway, who I thank in my acknowledgments, who lives alone on a wooden sailboat and sails around by herself in Arctic Norway, which was very relevant to the book because a lot of the sailing happens in sort of the Arctic waters. And so she was very kind and answered a lot of questions that I had about, you know, technical things. And then there was another author that I sort of, he sat down, Tobias Buckell, who's a science fiction author. He's also, like, he basically grew up sailing boats. And he talked me through some of the action scenes and helped correct some of the, like, you know, that there's a specific scene where they, you know, rescue somebody on a boat, and he helped me sort of block that out, which was really helpful. So hopefully it's the sailing stuff ended up being mostly accurate, but I'm sure I'll get some emails from people in the future saying, like, you know, it's not this, it's that.
I mean, I really love that, you know, like, I'm also a big fan of speculative fiction, and I really especially love stories that, you know, takes place in a world, right? Like, in like the world building in your book is just so fleshed out. You know, it does takes place in our future, but also, like, it's unrecognizable to us. And the fact that, like, you know, it's a road trip, like a big part of your novel is a road trip, but on the open sea. And I thought that was just really, really cool. I'm curious, you know, like, I'm always fascinated with just world building in, like, science fiction in general. How did you go about envisioning, like, your post-ecological collapse near future setting? Like,
well, I mean, I always build out a timeline, a pretty intense timeline that is both the history of the characters, the generational history of the characters' families, and also the world events that sort of led to this world that we're in. I did that for the Stardust Grail. I did that for the Deep Sky. And I did that for Salt Crop. And I may never mention those events on page, but it's helpful for me to sort of just have a sense of, like, major events that sort of got us to where we are. And then I also did, you know, a lot of, you know, just detail question. Like, sometimes I'll even, like, ask myself a set of questions and then I'll answer them. And just sort of when I do my first draft, I intentionally overwrite and put in a lot of detail as I'm sort of building it out and asking, just constantly asking yourself questions like, well, you know, would they be using this, or, like, what, you know, if they don't have plastic, what would the thing be that they use in this case, or how would they fix this thing? And just you're constantly asking yourself questions as you write. And then what I do is I intentionally, when I go back in revision, I cut out a lot of the detail that I added, because I think that when you are thinking about a good book, and or any book really, I don't think the point is to, like, draw a really detailed picture for somebody. I think a really good book is more like a constellation of stars, where you look at the reader comes to the picture and sees the spaces and sort of projects themselves into the spaces. And that's what makes a book. A book is a conversation between a writer and a reader, which is why everyone's reading experience is so different. Each book that they read is different. And sometimes you can read a book as somebody who's young and read a book as somebody who's old. And, you know, your experience reading that book is totally different. But I think, so for that reason, you know, when I come back to the book and I'm revising it, I'll intentionally trim out a lot of the details to make it a sort of slimmer book, so that it leaves space for a little bit of projection. And I that may be personal taste, but I think that that's important. And I also think, like, it's not necessary for you to know that what the exact, you know, set of miles was that they sailed from X place to Y place and how many knots they were sailing at. But it's important probably for the integrity of the story that I know what it is, and that you, more importantly, believe that I know what it is, in order for it to be a sort of, for it to hold up and to reader credibility. So I do a lot of work that I intentionally then don't include in the page, but hopefully it comes through with some confidence.
I will say that I was at first surprised that there was no map, before I started reading the book, because I'm so used to seeing maps and like fantasies and like sci-fi stories. And I was like, huh, well, this is a big chunk of this book is like a road trip, like Marvin said, only in the sea, but we don't have a map. And it kind of made sense to me while like when I got to like the first quarter of the book, because our characters have very limited resources and how to like navigate. So it's like, okay, well, they don't have a map. So so it makes sense for the readers to not have it as well.
That actually was a that was something that I did intentionally. And I'm actually curious to see how people receive it. But when you read a good dystopian novel, there's a lot of times there's a sort of a surreal feel to it, because they don't name places. You know, sometimes it's just the town or the city, and they don't name the year. So a lot of times, obviously this is not like, it's not a rule. It's just something that gives certain dystopian novels a feel, is an intentional lack of detail that makes it feel like it could be anywhere, any place. And my goal. Obviously, when you read it, you read it and you're like, oh, I think I can figure out exactly where this might be, which is fine. But I did want it to feel sort of like it could be anywhere. And I also wanted to create, sort of in combination with some of the detail choices, which were very grounded and very specific. And then you have this sort of intentional vagueness about the actual locations. And no map, as you said. And I wanted to sort of feel like it had a nice dissonance between the surreal and the real, that hopefully makes you feel like slightly uneasy and off balance in a way that is fun. So that was intentional. And obviously, if I did a map, the map would just be, it would look like the world. So I didn't want it to feel too real. Which I think it would have if I had included a map, because then you would see exactly, you know, where they are.
Sorry, my wife just took my son away, so I also have twins, so it's kind of cool that you have a twin too.
Yeah, I'm an identical twin. Yeah.
Well, nice. Yeah, mine's are a boy girl fraternal.
Okay. Yeah. It's a very efficient way to have children.
efficient but hard. I'm
yeah,
assuming,
both. So. Yeah. Yeah. My mother had we have a sister who's 1 year older, and I have an identical twin, so you can imagine how many diapers my parents
that's
were
a lot
changing.
Of diapers, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so you have sisters, and
I do, yeah.
Yeah, so that really comes through, because when I was reading, I was like, this is someone who has sisters, they understand sisterhood. And your story is split into three different POVs, and you know, I feel like that is kind of risky for a writer, because it's not so much like you're alternating chapters, like you stick with one sister for like a good chunk of the book. And then all of a sudden it's like, OK, we're going into a second sister's POV. And I don't know, like I feel like that can make a writer a little bit nervous, because there's the chance where the reader might just be like, oh, I was vibing with this one character.
Yeah,
now
yeah.
The protagonist has changed. So was that always like your intention to have three separate POVs and not have it be alternating chapters?
You know, I looked back actually recently just to see what my proposal was. I sold this book on proposal, meaning you write an outline and you write 100 pages and then they buy it based on that rather than the full manuscript. The answer is no. I didn't know that I was going to change POVs at all. The plot was basically the same, but I think what happened was I got to a certain place in the narrative, and it's like a big sort of the end of a big climax, and I sort of got stuck. And so I broke through that by starting to write in second person. Which didn't make it into the novel, but I wrote the next chunk in second person from the other sister's point of view, and it just started to flow again. And it was like, you know, one of those magical moments in writing where you don't know what the book needs, and then all of a sudden it just sort of comes out, and sort of the pen sort of guides you. And as soon as I made that switch, it just immediately started flowing. And then again, you know, once I did those two, I got to the again another climax point, and I said, okay, like now I have to switch to the other sister. And that one I wrote in first person. And then I did a bunch of beta reads, and second person is so controversial. And I chickened out, and I was like, this is maybe a bridge too far. So I made everything into third person, which I stand by. Like, I think that was probably the right choice anyway. But I do think it's kind of interesting because there's something about the rhythm of the second and the third parts that I think you can sort of tell that it's slightly different rhythm from the first part. And the reason is because there's sort of a residue of the way that it was originally written.
Yeah. I mean, I really love that you have, you know, each of arcs follows a different sister, and they're all like, they all have their own style, right? Like Skipper, the youngest sister, it's like, that's our road trip. That's our boat trip across, you know, the sea. You know, Carmen, the middle sister, it's more of like a, almost like a heist thriller in a way, in like a company town, which is also really awesome. And then, you know, Nora's, the older sister, kind of becomes a corporate thriller. So it's like three different like flavors of speculative fiction, but one cohesive like family drama.
Yeah, and I think part of the reason why I think it was the right choice to switch POVs is that when you're thinking about families and how they view each other, there's always a little bit of a difference about like how you see yourself and how your family sees yourself, and how you remember things and how your sisters remember things. And so you, having read this, you know, you'll see I played with that a little bit, where there are some key moments in their life that they each remember very differently. And how they remember it or how they experienced that moment really shaped who they are and the choices they make today. And I think by letting you sort of so when you get to this, the first POV change, it is a little bit of a moment of like, oh no, because for a lot of people I know who a lot of my friends who've read it, they get to Carmen and they're like, ugh, F Carmen, I don't really like her. She's like so annoying. Right. Because that's sort of like been the experience when you're sort of seeing it through Skipper's point of view. And then hopefully you see Skipper's point of view and you sort of change your mind about like the things that you've seen and the ways that she sort of acted towards her sister. And you start to understand her a little bit better. And, you know, the same thing again when you meet the third sister and you sort of understand the choices that she made and how she sort of views her sisters and how they view her and how that's different. I think also like I made some very deliberate choices about pacing and how each section is paced that may be controversial. But I definitely was, especially like with when you get to the, I'm trying to say this without like giving away spoilers, but like, you know, I think it's meant to sort of convey a certain state of the world and the sort of inconsistency in the way that people, the way that countries sort of develop under different conditions, and, you know, how countries can have very different ways of life depending on like the conditions that they're experiencing. And obviously it's not, there's not a fairness aspect to it. It's just like, you know, some countries are, you know, struggling and some countries are not. So, there's a very deliberate choice about the pacing, that is meant to be like, you know, sort of representative of like quote unquote real dystopia, and like what a real dystopia for our climate dystopia for our world might be. Yeah, I'm interested to hear the reception to that, because I also know that might be a hard sell for some people.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as in a lot of speculative fiction, like corporate capitalism is kind of the main antagonizing force in our future, and quite honestly, our present, really. And, you know, specifically the fact that, you know, like the way that the system's set up now, profits are always valued more above people, and that becomes even more extreme once, you know, conditions collapse, right? And I really enjoyed how, you know, you let each of your characters come to terms with their relationship and sometimes even complicity in the systems. Can you talk about like kind of, you know, it's easy to write like science fiction and being like, oh, capitalism bad, but like it takes a really good, I feel like you do a really good job like kind of not being like super didactic about it. Like, we feel that capitalism bad, but you're not overtly telling us like this is why things are bad. It's just like your characters live real lives under the systems and they kind of come to their consciousness of like, wait, things are kind of messed up here.
Right. I wonder if I think part of it goes back to, again, like my own life experience, right? Like I'm somebody who's chosen to work from within the system, a system that many would argue is pretty broken. And you know, there are many moments where you like ask yourself, like, is this salvageable? Is what we're doing futile, or are we actually inching forward to some better future? Or what does real change in a system look like, incremental or like wholesale? And how do you have these sea changes? Because there have been sea changes in history where, you know, people, large swaths of people, change their mind about something, sometimes in a good way and sometimes in a bad way. So like, it is possible to inspire change, or for change to happen organically. And, you know, it doesn't, sometimes it means like working within the system, and sometimes it means working without the system. So I think that's sort of the perspective that I bring to, you know, the worlds that I construct. And I think it's realistic, like as satisfying as it is in some dystopian novels to sort of have a character sort of say, I'm going to like bring down the whole system. I think realistically, most of us are not that kind of hero. And most of us are, when terrible things are happening, are going to just focus on our lives. And I don't think that makes you selfish. I think that makes you human. Like, I think it's very human to not sort of assume the worst about what's happening, and just sort of like to sort of focus on what's in front of you and sort of keep walking forward and living your life day by day as terrible things are happening around you. And like, you know, maybe that is self-centered, but I think like that's natural. And then something happens that like completely shakes you up, and suddenly you're forced to actually take a step to do something. And, you know, it's not really a heroic way to live your life, but I think it's a realistic way to write a character in this kind of world, because for the most part, like the choices that we make, or, you know, the things that we decide to do are not going to be like as bold as, you know, some of the heroes that we reread about in some stories.
Yeah. I, like speaking of change, like I was just like thinking about, the recurring theme in your book of like responsibility. Like, not only is like this like there's individual responsibility in like climate change, but also like it's systemic, right? There are like corporations who are, you know, making it very hard for us to, you know, have collectivism to make change. And it like really brings up the question of like, how can we contribute to change when we don't have the means or energy? And you see that with each of the sisters, like they each believe they have a responsibility to like each sister, and also like their grandmother, who's like, you know, slowly deteriorating. And at the same time, there's like this yearning to be selfish and to make decisions that only affect themselves and not anyone else. And they feel guilty about it. So I just want to hear your thoughts on like who are we responsible for in a collapsing world where everyone is struggling to survive? Like, what is considered the right thing to do in that regard?
Yeah, and I think I think what you're putting your finger on is the reason that we have failed to do anything about climate change in a really broad way. Because it's very hard to care about the entire human population of the world. It's such an abstract thing. But, you know, when it's your sister, you know, of course, that's something that requires immediate action. And, you know, when I find hope, I think it's like in the ways that we view each other at a sort of more individual level or micro level, than the things that we're trying to do to like make life better for the people that are in our immediate surroundings. You know, that is like where you might inspire people to act. You know, when you see people sort of finally taking action, it's usually because they've suddenly realized, and this is not, I mean, there are many people who are brave and bold and caring and like empathetic, you know, and able to sort of care about things that are not immediately in front of them. And I think those people are the best kind of people. But many ordinary people, I think, until the problem feels personal, it's very hard to sort of prioritize it above your immediate needs. And so, I mean, I think that was, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about as I was sort of writing this book is that, and like how, you know, you see a sort of shift in their, you know, a tension in their mindset between like, you know, understanding that there are real problems that they're not dealing with. And also like each one of them sort of reaches a point where they're sort of forced to confront the broader things and have to decide, as you said, like, you know, what, how far they're willing to go to sort of deal with it, and whether they're willing to like discard their day-to-day norms to, and make any sacrifices to sort of address it.
Speaking of problems they're not dealing with, the sisters, they remind me of like so many Asian families that, you know, have had like a traumatic incident that happened in the family, but they bury that trauma and they never discuss it. And it's just like we just have to work hard and take care of each other. Like, we are never going to address like all the issues, like the source of all the issues that we have. And each of the sisters, they kind of internalize their traumas in different ways. You have Skipper, who kind of alienates herself because she feels like she is left out in her family. And then you have like Carmen, who, you know, feels like she needs to be loved by everyone. And then you have Nora, who, you know, makes assumptions about like how people see her. And also she feels like responsible for everyone and everything. So I am curious as to like, did you think about like the Asian American context to this of like, yeah, like we don't talk about our problems.
It's funny. I'm half Asian. So I'm half Japanese, half like, you know, white American, formerly puritanical. And the like quote unquote WASP culture is actually kind of similar in this respect, where like you don't necessarily talk about like if somebody's sick in the family, it's not necessarily like the major point of conversation, you know, like somebody in your family might be sick and you might not even know, you know, because you don't talk about it. But and so it's like there's, I would say actually it's not an intentional thing. Like, I think it's just like because of the like combined background sort of comes through like that. It's like in both cases, I think you like you don't talk about certain things. And I think that makes for a much more fun subtle conflict. Like, you know, it's everything is subsurface and subtextual, and you don't necessarily like have a big confrontation about it. There are many things that they're sort of overdue to talk about that they haven't talked about for years.
Yeah, I mean, in addition to being a great piece of speculative fiction, it's also a really great family drama. And the, when that confrontation happens, it's just cathartic.
Yeah. Yeah, and they finally realize that maybe they were wrong about some things, right?
Yeah.
I mean, each of the sisters, they're unreliable narrators. Like, we find this out with reading each POV, and, you know, they have misconceptions about each other, and there's, like, a lot of miscommunication. And it's just, like, as someone who does not have sisters, I do find it, like, very interesting and funny that you have, like, sisters who are willing to, you know, sail across, like, the ends of the earth to save you, but at the same time you're pissed off at them and you're just like, you made my life so hard, like how could you do this to me? Can you like talk just about like the dynamics of the sisterhood in your book?
Yeah, I mean, I love stories that are about relationships that are not romantic. I think it's so interesting to like explore that sibling love, because it is a love that is not based necessarily on pure understanding. It's based a lot on the common mythos that you've sort of built together and the childhood that you've shared. But the people that you knew when you were children are very different from the people they are today, right? Like, that you feel that when you come back to a Thanksgiving dinner and you find yourself sort of being sort of stuffed back in the box of whatever your childhood self was. And that's I think in a nutshell is like what makes siblings so interesting, right? Because you have this loyalty and love, and it's all based on, you know, something that happened 20 years ago or 30 years ago, and you may not know them as well as you are so confident that you think you do. But at the same time, it sort of doesn't matter. you know, whether they're still the same person that they were back then, because your tolerance and your level of forgiveness and your, you know, how much you value them and like are willing to sort of sacrifice for them is great. And I love stories that do sibling quests like that, because I think it's so interesting to sacrifice so much or be willing to sacrifice so much for somebody that you may ultimately not know as well as you think you do.
Yeah, it's like a group assignment that neither one has signed up for, but they have to work together. And at the same time, they're just bickering the entire time. So it is like a fun dynamic to read, especially between Carmen and Skipper, because those two fight a lot.
That, yeah, sibling squabbles, yeah.
Something that I really enjoy, especially in the first part as well, is kind of your the boat, Skipper's boat, Bumblebee, which is a boat that they built together as a family. And you had this, like, to, in my mind, like subtle jab at just like, we don't repair things anymore, right? We're not allowed to like fix things. Like, I was thinking about this when I was taking my car in for maintenance. It's like, it's all computers in there. Like, I can't go and like replace a part on my own. I have to take it into where it's built. And just to remind them about like, yeah, when everything falls apart, you kind of, community kind of closes again. You kind of learn to do things on your own again. And these are things that we always were able to do, but we've been convinced that like, no, we need the company to like give us the things.
Yeah. And I think that's like, they're like in the height of the pandemic, that was sort of, I think, something that people started to get back in touch with, not to like over, not to be overly nostalgic about that otherwise very horrible period, but like, you know, there was a lot of sort of retrenchment in learning how to sew and learning how to make bread. And, you know, because part of it is motivated by like, you don't necessarily want to go to the store to get stuff, or you can't necessarily go to the store to because some things are closed, or like, you know, you don't want to be exposed just to get this thing fixed. And or maybe you have more time because you're stuck at home and you can't do a lot of things. So you know, I think there was sort of an aspect of that where people are sort of relearning some skills. I do think like part of it is also the way things are manufactured now, right? Your phone is designed to not last very long because they want you to get another phone. Or like, you know, my parents have a washer dryer that has been broken for, you know, 5 or 6 years. And part of the issue is that like, there's a computer chip that needs to be replaced. And, you know, why does your washing machine need a computer chip? But like, but you know, it would be cheaper to buy a new machine than it would be to replace that chip. And I'm sure that's, you know, probably by design, right? Because they'd make more money if you buy a new machine. So even if they wanted to fix that washer dryer, I think they couldn't. They'd have to get a new one. So they've just been using a broken one and it works fine as long as you know, like, you know, you know how to reset it, and you punch it a couple times, you know, so like it still works, and so they keep using it. But you know, when I was sort of developing the world, that's sort of in my mind is like, you know, what are the kind of products that you can fix, and what are the kind of products that like you probably can't fix and might have to do without?
Yeah, like one of my favorite passages in your book, I'm not going to read it out loud because I want people to experience like the prose themselves, but it's when Skipper comes across like this floating island of just
garbage.
Trash.
Yeah.
And it just like, you just go into detail of like what all the trash is. And I'm like,
right.
Yeah. I'm just like, that's just us right now. Like, it's so hard not to consume things because the corporations, like, they're pushing this on us. And there are things that obviously we can't fix ourselves because of the way things are that are manufactured. And just like how just looking at the stuff that got trashed, it's just like it's like looking at a fossil, you know, like just like this archive of history. And it's a little sad because you think about like how, when I think about the pandemic, of course, it was like a horrible time. People were dying and like losing their jobs and stuff. But it was also like a very hopeful time for climate change, because like very shortly after, like, there was like no cars on highways. Mm-hmm. Like, we saw like an immediate change. And
yeah, we live in LA and the skies were blue for that entire
skies
like
were
for 2 years.
Animals
yeah.
were coming back, like
traffic related deaths plunged.
Yeah, and then like, you know, the air got cleaner, but then corporations are like, "Hey, we're not making money, so we need to like make people do work again." And it I was just like, we could have had a moment. An era of like self-sufficiency and clean air, but all of that is gone now. And so reading that passage, I was like, ah,
yeah. And that's and us. Also like I will just say, when I was revising that passage, I, you know, was sort of, it may not read this way when you read it, but I want you to know that I did think very carefully about what I was including in that list. And a lot of the things that are included in that list are moments of joy and, you know, pleasure. So mm-hmm. it's not meant to be just like a condemnation of our lifestyle, because I think that would be too simplistic. Like, I think a lot of times, like the things that we, you know, I mean, getting on a plane is terrible for the environment. And not getting on a plane means, you know, not getting to sort of explore the world. So it is a tough choice, I think, for a lot of people, even knowing what the impact is. And, you know, it's so each of those, when you read that passage, like each of the objects in that are sort of meant to be things that are like actually, you know, not just like throwaway things. I mean, they are throwaway things, but things.
Yeah,
that,
some
like,
of those things were
at
treasure.
One point. Yeah, exactly. Were treasures at one point. Yeah.
I mean, the world is bad, but we need our joy. You know?
Yes,
like,
exactly.
The world keeps churning.
Yeah. The delight of like, you know, putting a quarter in a machine and getting a bouncy ball. You know, it's like
yeah. We've been kind of like talking about anti-capitalism and just like how these big corporations are making it kind of impossible to have. Effective climate change. Can you tell us your inspirations for renewal, which is like the big bad
yeah.
in your book?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in some ways is like the least speculative aspect of that book, because there are a lot of things that happen now in agriculture, in the agricultural industry, that are basically already true. And so, in fact, like some of it was actually like not that much of a stretch. But so I did a lot of research into, you know, reading books about the current agricultural industry and pesticides and how genetically modified crops, you know, were developed, and how that sort of interplays with the pesticide industry in a way that, like, you know, it makes you very concerned. And then I just took it like, you know, one step further. But I would say actually that is like in some ways like the nearest future aspect of the book. A lot of the elements that you're reading there that are like both dystopian and also like currently true.
Well, also like it kind of felt historical to me in some ways, because like of the way, like there's a setting in your book, it's Vault City, and it's I'm not going to tell you guys why the sisters are there, but it is a company town, and currency is just, you know, company points. And it reminded me of like slavery run plantations in America, where they had like also sharecropping. Yeah,
right. Or the northern company towns where like you'd have like, you know, garment factory workers, you know, who, you know, usually like lots of young women who are brought in and sort of were working for low wages and also being docked to pay for, you know, cost of living. So definitely there are historic sort of foundations for that model.
And also just like you said, it is like the least speculative part of your book. And also just like reminded me of the industrial prison complex, because like that is also tied to agriculture. Now, here in America, they are using prisoners for pretty much slave labor on the fields. And I'm like, oh, okay, this is a little bit too close to our reality. But that's what makes it engaging in storytelling.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I went to business school, I studied business, and understanding how decisions are made on a corporate level, we're already in like a dystopic place where like numbers are more important than people. And so like, you take that to a setting where like, you know, it doesn't really seem there's much of a government. It seems like the corporations are the government. And so like, if there's no one to regulate them, we go back to the exploited days of like the baron, robber barons, right?
And I think one of the things that I was playing with the world building is a world where the governments are much weaker because people have, because corporations have become much, you know, have continued to become more powerful and governments have become, you know, a little bit more dismantled. And so the regulatory aspect, you know, that we, I think, sort of take for granted and is somewhat invisible in our day-to-day life is missing from this world.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one positive thing about our current reality right now. We're not there yet. Let's hope we don't ever get there.
Right.
So we're nearing the end of our talk, and this was like so much fun talking to you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
I want to know, like, are you working on anything else? Like, it seems like speculative fiction sci-fi is your jam. So do you ever plan to like stray out of that genre and try something new?
Yeah. So my next book is a speculative thriller. And that's coming out in 2027. We just pushed the pub date back because I wanted more time to work on it. I was supposed to hand it in this week and I was like, you know, I think I could really use another 6 months. Even though I would love to get paid for it, you know, it's already been sold, but you know, I don't get paid until I turn it in. But that one is like it's more like The Deep Sky, my first book. It's a murder mystery, multi POV thriller about, five astronauts who were sent to make first contact with aliens and then, you know, came back and it's 10 years later and they're sort of dealing with this sort of aftermath of that. And then one of them gets murdered and they have to figure out, you know, who did it and why. And then after that, though, I might write a horror book. I mean, I haven't sold it, but I have a office horror satire idea that I would love to write. So that I don't think I've talked about publicly, but anyway, so you heard it here first. That's probably my next idea. So to answer your question, I would love to try other genres. You know, I read a lot of science fiction up to this point, but I read a lot of different things. So I would definitely love to venture into other genres. It's tough because when you're an author, you're sort of developing a brand and sort of people come to expect certain things, and you know, you want to make sure that your books are selling and continue to sell. So I know it's like kind of risky sometimes to play around, but you know, also you're an artist and you want to try new things. So I think like just doing the same thing over and over again is not the point. So we'll see. I think it'll be fun. It's going to be like Severance meets you know, the book Bunny.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that sounds real dark.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, no, we mentioned that your Salt Crop is essentially three sub-genres within the book. So, like, we believe in you. We'll read whatever.
Oh, thank
you. We'll take whatever comes from you.
Well, we look forward to seeing you expand your horizons and your next piece of work. Thank you so much for chatting with us, Yume.
Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, thank you.
And that was Yume Kitase. Her latest novel, Salt Crop, is available now at booksellers everywhere, including, as always, the Books and Boba bookshop. So if our conversation piqued your interest in the book, you can pick up a copy by heading over to booksandboba.com and checking out our online bookstore. As always, all purchases made on our bookshop support not only us here at Books and Boba, but also your local bookstores. All right. So before we call it an episode, Mira, can you please remind us what we are reading this month for book club?
Yeah, so we are reading Bat Eater and Other Names for Cora Zhang, written by Kylie Lee Baker. This was chosen by our Patreon members, and it is a horror novel who follows Cora Zhang, a crime scene cleaner who is haunted by inner trauma, hungry ghosts, and a serial killer. Lots of dark things happening. So this is a perfect spooky read for us.
Yeah. So if you are a member of our Patreon, we are discussing the book as we read on Discord. So please join in the conversation. As always, we'd love to include your feedback on our discussion episodes whenever possible. And definitely, like, you know, it's a pretty gruesome book. So proceed with caution. With that, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you once again to Yume Kitase for joining us. And we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue.
follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hungry for spicy food and even hotter conversations? Craving community and authentic storytelling? Then join the table. This is Minor Legends, a new comedy fiction podcast supported by Potluck. Pull up every week with me, Angela Wong Carbone, and follow the stories of me and my friends as we serve up tasty tales of what it means to be Asian American at our weekly dinner hang. If you enjoy deep dishing on absurd stereotypes like tiger moms who tutor your dating game rather than grades, the insanity of your parents' immigration story, to the legend of that one good Asian cousin you can never live up to, then pull up a seat and grab a plate. Featuring dinner guests like Ronnie Chang, Brian Park, Usama Siddiqui, Celia Au, Perry Young, Supriya Ganesh, and more. It's a tasty rotation that'll leave you belly laughing and steeped in relatable and spicy conversations. Can you take the heat? Listen now for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Kim Cooper, and I co-host the podcast Asians in Baseball alongside Naomi Koh and Scott Okamoto. Asians in Baseball is exactly what it sounds like, a podcast about the Asian and Asian Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Americans in Major League Baseball. Every week, we break down the highlights of what's going on with Asians in baseball and then take a deeper dive into the Asian and Asian Americans past and present who have shaped baseball as it is today. Whether you're Kim Eng's number one fan or you've never even heard of Hideo Nomo, we've got something for everyone, especially for the Shohei Ohtani stans. Maybe too much for the Shohei Ohtani stans. Listen to Asians in Baseball wherever you get podcasts, part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.
Great news! The Korean Drama Podcast is back for our sixth season.
The Korean Drama Podcast is the podcast about watching Korean dramas by people who don't watch Korean dramas. Hosted by Candace, Jane, and me, Kim.
Wait, if it's our sixth season, can we still say we're people who don't watch Korean dramas?
I'm sure it's fine. Let's just call it character development, which we love in K-dramas.
For our new season, we're recapping the hit 2025 romantic fantasy series, Heavenly Ever After, about an elderly couple who reunite in the afterlife. Only he's now in his 30s while she's chosen to appear in her 80s.
Awkward.
So join us each week as we discuss the highs and lows of the afterlife in Heavenly Ever After, episode by episode.
Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.
And I co-host the podcast Asians in Baseball alongside Naomi Koh and Scott Okamoto. Asians in Baseball is exactly what it sounds like, a podcast about the Asian and Asian Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Americans in Major League Baseball. Every week, we break down the highlights of what's going on with Asians in baseball and then take a deeper dive into the Asian and Asian Americans past and present who have shaped baseball as it is today. Whether you're Kim Eng's number one fan or you've never even heard of Hideo Nomo, we've got something for everyone, especially for the Shohei Ohtani stans. Maybe too much for the Shohei Ohtani stans. Listen to Asians in Baseball wherever you get podcasts, part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.